From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, riot hit Ferguson sees a second night of unrest. Clashes as Hong Kong authorities clear more protests. South Korea considering bills to improve human rights in North Korea. Is the Iran nuclear negotiations extension a step forward or a step backward? And environmentalists focus on Lima, Peru, with hopes of a new climate treaty. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. The Midwestern U.S. town of Ferguson saw a second night of unrest, and solidarity demonstrations were held nationwide to protest a grand jury's decision to not indict a white police officer who shot and killed an unarmed black teenager, Michael Brown. More than 2,000 National Guard soldiers have been deployed in Ferguson, Missouri, to guard against fresh racially charged riots, which broke out late Monday after it was announced that charges would not be filed against Officer Darren Wilson. VOA's Alicia Tanzim, who is in Ferguson, says there has been no repeat of the widespread looting that was seen on the first night of protests when over a dozen buildings were set on fire. A tense moment occurred late Tuesday when a group of protesters smashed the windows of and set fire to a police car in front of Ferguson City Hall. Tanzim says a large number of riot police and National Guard troops approached the area in armored vehicles and ordered the protesters to disperse. Police declared the gathering to be illegal and warned that those refusing to leave would be arrested. St. Louis County Police Chief John Belmar confirmed at a late-night news conference that there were no other instances of major unrest, but he said that 44 people were arrested overnight, adding to the 61 that were arrested a night earlier. President Barack Obama on Tuesday said he deplored the destructive acts, saying they are criminal and those responsible should be prosecuted. But America's first black president said he understands that many people are upset by the grand jury decision. The shooting death in Ferguson has brought to the surface unresolved racial tensions that still exist in the United States. Zlatica Hoke has this report for VOA Television.
African-American groups nationwide have raised their voices against what they call continued racial inequality.
We can no longer just allow funeral after funeral after funeral after funeral and killing after killing after killing after killing to go on.
Demonstrations have taken place nationwide to protest the grand jury's decision. In addition to St. Louis, protesters have come out in major American cities, including New York. Many protesters say they are marching to draw attention to a wider problem.
I know that a lot of us gathered around Michael Brown, but he's one of thousands.
Students at Indiana University held a moment of silence for the shooting victim, Michael Brown.
No justice!
Some high school students in Minneapolis walked out of classes to protest the jury decision. On the West Coast, protesters in Los Angeles expressed anger at how police in this country treat African Americans in general.
Well, it's interesting. My reaction is I was not surprised. Definitely in the United States of America, white police officers are killing and white security guards are killing black individuals every 28 hours. So it was not a surprise to me. I think what's more important to me is what people out here and on the streets are prepared to do to stop the execution of black and brown bodies in our communities.
House Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi expressed disappointment at the jury's decision and said more needs to be done to address the discontent of America's black people.
The reaction, obviously needs to be addressed. That is to say, there is an unhappiness, a discontent in our communities about the relationship of everyone.
It seems that more anger is directed at the law enforcement system than at the jury made up of 12 randomly selected Missouri residents.
I feel like things were thoroughly considered and that it was a just outcome.
Many Americans are calling for new regulations that would curb the police use of lethal weapons.
They have stun guns, they got the pop guns that they can use. You can protect yourself in other ways besides deadly force.
The United Nations Human Rights Chief on Tuesday said the United States needs to examine the deep mistrust among some population segments and how race relations affect law enforcement. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
Hong Kong authorities cleared a main protest camp today and arrested two leaders of the Occupy movement, which is calling for greater democracy in the semi-autonomous Chinese territory. Police hauled away several protesters, including student leaders Lester Shum and Joshua Wong, during the several-hour operation to clear barricades from a road on the Mong Kong neighborhood. Scuffles broke out when some protesters tried to prevent workers from tearing down the barricades on Nathan Road, a major six-lane thoroughfare that had been blocked by protesters for 2 months. It was the third time authorities have cleared protest sites since Hong Kong's High Court approved the actions earlier this month. On Tuesday, police said they arrested 116 people during an operation to clear another part of Mong Kong. Protesters still remain camped out at two other sites near government headquarters in the Admiralty District and in the popular shopping district of Causeway Bay. The demonstrators have been calling for fully democratic elections in 2017. They took to the streets after China ruled in August that all candidates for Hong Kong's chief executive must first be approved by a committee that is stacked with pro-Beijing loyalists. Following the recent United Nations resolution condemning the dire human rights situation in North Korea, the South Korean parliament is now considering taking action on this issue. VOA's Brian Padden reports from Seoul that the situation has revived a long-standing debate in the South over how to affect change in the North.
The two major political parties in South Korea have somewhat diametrically opposed views on North Korea. The ruling conservative Saenuri Party supports cautious dealings with the secretive and authoritarian Kim Jong-un regime. The bill it is sponsoring in parliament would provide funding for North Korean human rights and civics groups operating in South Korea and would empower the Justice Ministry to document human rights violations in North Korea. Choi Young-sung, a secretary general of Network for North Korean Democracy and Human Rights, supports this bill. He says basically the government must cooperate with North Korea by having talks, but it also needs to punish if North Korea provokes. The more liberal New Politics Alliance for Democracy Party believes that outside agitation and condemnation will only further isolate the regime. Its bill supports increased engagement with North Korea, offering humanitarian aid and economic cooperation to bring about change. Moon Jae-in is a leader of this opposition party and a former presidential candidate. He says what his opposition party thinks is that the North Korean Human Rights Bill and the support of the South Korean government must be effective. Moon Jae-in specifically opposes any government funding for North Korean defector groups that have been launching balloons filled with anti-regime leaflets across the border. A recent launch provoked a military exchange of gunfire at the border and angered North Korean leaders to the point where they canceled high-level talks to ease military tensions. Moon Jae-in says they harm the national interest of South Korea. It violates current law, and under the inter-Korean exchange law, one must get an approval from the unification minister in order to send things to North Korea. Since 2005, there have been a number of South Korean legislative proposals to address the dire human rights conditions in the North, but until now there has not been a strong enough consensus across party lines to pass a bill. That may be changing in light of the United Nations committee vote calling on the Security Council to refer North Korea to the International Criminal Court for alleged human rights violations. A UN report also detailed decades of systematic abuse in North Korea, including a network of political prisons holding more than 100,000 people and atrocities that include murder, torture, rape, and forced abortions. Choi Young-sung says the UN action has helped restart negotiations between the two parties to come up with a compromise bill. The UN resolution to prosecute Kim Jong-un and other leaders in the International Criminal Court must first pass the UN Security Council, but Russia or China are likely to block it. Brian Padden, VOA News, Seoul.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's VOAnews.com. VOAnews.com. Online news for a changing world.
Iran and the so-called P5 plus one negotiators have agreed to an extension of up to 7 months on the Iran nuclear talks, a move that could give both sides more breathing room as they try to reach consensus on Tehran's uranium enrichment levels. But analysts say the length of the deadline extension could also indicate the two sides remain far apart on core issues. VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins has this look at the issue.
In a Tuesday briefing, State Department spokesman Jeff Rafke said Iran nuclear negotiators are closer to a deal that would make the entire world safer and more secure. He downplayed the significance of the 7-month extension in talks.
The extension is just an extension. It does not provide additional sanctions relief for Iran.
But Atlantic Council nuclear analyst Matthew Kranig says the extension could be an indication of deadlock.
According to my sources, there's really been very little progress made.
He says all of the major issues identified a year ago are still major issues, including enrichment levels, sanctions relief, and a decision on how long a final deal would remain in place.
There's really no reason to believe that if we continue the same strategy, that we'll make any progress in the next 7 months.
Brookings Institution analyst Ricardo Alcaro says he was both surprised and disappointed by the 7-month extension, but he says the extra time could be beneficial.
For the 5 plus 1, to keep on negotiating all things remaining the same is okay, because the alternative is much worse.
He says the prospect of a final deal is still plausible.
There is a possibility you can get to a deal. However, in terms of odds, I am more pessimistic than optimistic. I must say that.
He says Iran's president and foreign minister may be ready to strike a deal, but the country's supreme leader does not appear to be convinced. Pam Dawkins, VOA News, the State Department.
Global oil prices steadied today after falling more than 2% Tuesday, with West Texas crude for January delivery trading at about $74 a barrel. Oil has fallen about 30% in value since June amid ample global supplies. The 12-member Organization of Petroleum Exporting Nations, OPEC, meets in Vienna Thursday to discuss cutting daily production levels to below the 30 million barrel ceiling it agreed to 3 years ago. Reports indicate the cartel will hold the line on output. Carl Leary, director of oil and gas for the market research consultancy Frost & Sullivan, tells VOA's Victor Beatty, OPEC faces a real conundrum given its lost market share to the United States.
The U.S. has been increasing its oil production to nearly double in the past 2 years, and so we've backed out a lot of oil barrels from OPEC here. Then the second part that OPEC's dealing with is that the competition for the remaining clients or the remaining consumers in the rest of the world is shrinking, and the biggest consumer outside the U.S. is China. So OPEC's really trying to find who is going to get to the front of that line. And that's where the biggest dilemma is in this meeting. It's not so much the fact that the U.S. is producing so much more because we still import crude, but the fact is that the rest of the world is just not, you know, not consuming as much as we just saw lost from the U.S. So, you know, you have these meetings with Russia, you have these meetings with Mexico, and what OPEC is trying to do is get a gauge on who's stepping up in front of Asia and China specifically.
Saudi Arabia has been playing it close to the vest with regard to what its intentions will be at this Vienna meeting. Does Saudi Arabia drive what OPEC ultimately does?
They normally do, but the issue now is really about what is Saudi Arabia willing to give up and what are they willing to concede in terms of competition. Before, the Saudis were always trying to figure out how they can rein in overproduction or, in the opposite end, how they can supply more to the market. Well, right now you have other countries, that, especially in OPEC, that are already under contract and supplying a lot of other people, and they want to stay in their position. They want to keep supplying who they're supplying. So if there's any cuts, the Saudis not only lose their production that they're making, but they're losing their spot in line. And that's the big trouble here that OPEC's facing. Nobody wants to give up their position within that cartel.
OPEC pumps, I guess, about a third of the world's oil supply. Right now, they've limited themselves to an output quota daily of 30 million barrels for the past 3 years. Do you anticipate that to stay about the same, to drop, or to rise?
I think it's going to drop. I think they will have to make a token cut, whether it's a million barrels a day, which I think would be satisfactory, or maybe less. And the way that would be less would probably be by cutting overproduction. They know that a lot of countries are overproducing because there's been issues in the past year or so with Libya and Iran. And so everybody's trying to make up for that. But it's caused a glut. And so now they're either going to have to curb overproduction, which is going to happen regardless, or they will make this obligatory cut of a million barrels a day, and that will support the market and at least firm prices up.
Larry says an Iran nuclear agreement could result in greater oil output, with Tehran adding 1 to 2 million barrels a day to global production, while eventual approval of the XL pipeline from Canada to the U.S. Gulf Coast would allow the U.S. to further reduce its reliance on OPEC imports. And Larry says a U.S. congressional hearing scheduled next month on ending a decades-old law prohibiting the U.S. from exporting crude oil appears to be the latest development in America's growing energy abundance. And as Republicans take hold of both houses of Congress in January, may eventually add even more oil to the global marketplace. Climate watchers will be focused on Lima, Peru in December as representatives of 200 countries gather for negotiations on a new climate treaty. It would replace the Kyoto Protocol, the global agreement that expired in 2012. As VOA's Roseanne Skirbel reports, hopes for success in this round of talks are boosted by recent agreements among the world's top polluters.
The meeting in Lima sets the stage for Paris in 2015, when nations will come together to agree on a binding climate treaty, says Jennifer Morgan, global director of the climate program at the World Resources Institute.
That all countries would be part of, which is one of the differences of the past, and that would stick around for a while. That would be a global agreement for decades to come. That would bring countries back to the table to strengthen their commitment to solving the problem.
Scientists affirm with increased certainty that the planet is getting hotter. Study after study shows that the world is well on its way toward a 2 degrees Celsius rise in temperature above pre-industrial levels. Experts say that would trigger extreme weather and rising seas, problems of global magnitude. The studies also show that climate-changing emissions from fossil fuels are to blame. Lima is about getting those emissions in check. Morgan points to growing momentum to get that done. In September, the United Nations held a climate summit to engage heads of state and industry leaders, and about 700,000 people crowded streets in New York City and elsewhere for the People's Climate March.
Then bounce into European heads of state in October saying, here's our offer to reduce at least 40% emissions. And then the U.S.-China announcement recently, where those two countries came forward in a pretty historic announcement of what they're willing to do on their numbers and their willingness to work together.
In that agreement between the world's top polluters, the U.S. committed to reducing emissions between 26 and 28% by 2025. And for the first time, China put a timetable on its actions, saying emissions would peak by 2030. Morgan says to get there, China must begin making massive cuts now.
It's not like they're going to wait 16 years. They actually have to shut down coal-fired power plants. They have to build up renewable energy. They have to be much more efficient in order to turn that curve.
The deal puts China in a leadership role for the first time. Other countries are expected to put their reduced emissions commitments on the table by March. Morgan says the U.S.-China announcement is a strategic move that could energize other nations to do more.
If you look at developed countries, it's fair to say that Australia or Canada haven't indicated when they are going to table their offer. Well, if China can offer something, certainly they can offer something too. And in developing countries, I think a country like India or Brazil, I think now are challenged to table their offers as well.
Morgan says it's critical to close the emissions gap between what is needed and what countries are expected to pledge. She says each nation will make reductions in its own way through national policies and laws, but only a global pact with binding commitments can exert pressure to get the job done.
So it's in the interest of every country to actually have a global approach so that they can be sure that what they're doing is being mirrored by others. You don't get that through bilateral deals. You don't get all of the emissions in place, and you don't take care of the most vulnerable countries around the world adequately. So you need to do this global. It's challenging, it's messy, but it's fundamental to move forward.
Morgan hopes that the Lima meeting will end with a text for a new treaty, one that will guide negotiators and lead governments to act. Roseanne Scherbel, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On November 26th, 1476, Vlad III, also known as Vlad the Impaler, the harsh ruler from whom the Dracula legend sprang, joined other leaders in defeating the ruler of the Principality of Wallachia. Vlad then became the ruler of the territory, which was located in modern-day Romania. In 1789, U.S. President George Washington proclaimed November 26th as a day of public thanksgiving and prayer. In 1941, President Franklin Roosevelt signed a measure into law making the fourth Thursday of each November an official Thanksgiving holiday. In 2000, George W. Bush was certified the winner of Florida's electoral votes, going on to win the United States presidential election following a Supreme Court vote. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This month, the world celebrates a natural resource that provides employment opportunities for 50 million people and food for billions, fisheries. World Fisheries Day, established in 1998 and celebrated annually on November 21st, highlights the importance of protecting the oceans and conserving marine life. President Barack Obama and U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry have made environmental sustainability a priority of U.S. foreign policy. They recognize the linkages between fisheries, food security, economic welfare, and people's health worldwide. In Africa, where more than 200 million people eat fish as a main source of protein, sustainable fishing is critical. The economic potential is also great. The fisheries sector employs more than 12 million Africans, and fish is a leading export, with an annual value of nearly $3 billion. Fisheries provide government revenues through fishing agreements and license fees from foreign fishing fleets, which also drive economic activity in regional ports. Protecting marine environments isn't just about fish, it's about people. Despite the resource's great importance, its health and sustainability face increasing challenges. Illegal and unregulated fishing is a major environmental problem and a form of wildlife trafficking. West African fisheries, one of the most diverse and economically important in the world, lose over $1 billion a year this way. The United States stands side by side with our African partners in addressing fisheries issues. 11 African countries join nearly 90 nations at the Our Ocean Conference, hosted by Secretary Kerry in June, where sustainable fisheries were one of the key themes discussed. In September, Secretary Kerry joined Mozambican Foreign Minister Oldemiro Baloy and Director General of the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, José Graciano, in hosting a follow-on meeting on the margins of the UN General Assembly. We applaud Gabon's announcement this month to create a 46,000-square-kilometer network of marine protected areas in its waters. This bold step shows Gabon's strong commitment to marine habitats, important species, and local livelihoods. African countries also were key voices in developing the Port State Measures Agreement, an international treaty that will make it harder for fishing vessels to land illegal catches at ports around the world, ensuring that countries profit from fish caught in their waters. From providing food to generating income to keeping marine ecosystems healthy, fish are an indispensable natural resource. The United States is committed to improving fisheries management, protecting the ocean, and safeguarding this marine bounty for generations to come.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.